I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, the radio conversation that rides the internet range, talking this hour about the immortal George Orwell. Big Brother is watching you was the warning of his novel 1984, written in the late 1940s at the start of the Cold War. Well, the ghost of George Orwell is listening to us and particularly to our political language. In his own time, Orwell said, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible, like imperialism in India and the nuclear bombing of Japan. For all time, Orwell said, political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. Help us out, Orwell. Help us out, listeners. Is there any purifying the public language of our times? The open source phone is 877-673-6767, or log in with a comment on our website at radioopensource.org. Our guest from Brown University, Abbott Gleason, known as Tom, has done a lot of thinking and writing about what it is that keeps Orwell alive. What's the answer, Tom Gleason?
Well, one answer, or one piece of the answer, is that the themes that Orwell wrote about are just as alive as they were in 1945 or 1984 or 1991. Themes like torture, the degradation of language, sexual politics, violence, torture. Did I mention torture?
Yep.
Those things were all features of the Cold War world that he wrote about, and yet the passing of that world has not led to any diminution in the dangers that those things present to people.
So it's the world as much as Orwell that keeps this stuff relevant.
I think it's the world, but of course, Orwell is just one of those people who created an extraordinary image for himself, and he created an image that everybody wanted to participate in. And I think probably almost everybody on the left and on the right feels that if they could get Orwell on their side, they'd have a tremendous legitimizing impact on whatever it was that they were saying.
Well, we'll come to that. I'd like to start, though, with 1984. And in a certain way, the transformation in 1984, it was written as a kind of a parable of Soviet Stalinist communism in the 1940s. And it, in a certain way, it was, I don't know if subsidized is the word, but it became a hugely popular American staple as a warning about communism. But then it took on a completely larger life of its own. Can you explain that?
Well, I think as long as the Cold War was in its early in its early stages, and as long as the Soviet Union was regarded as a deeply mysterious entity, as long as there was terrible curiosity about what it was like over there, it had 1984 had a sort of revelatory anti-Soviet aspect to it. But as people became more familiar with the Soviet Union, as Soviet politics became a little clearer, even if people didn't approve of them, it didn't seem, I think, any longer to have that revelatory message that it had in 1946 or when it came out in 1949. And of course, at the end of the Cold War, it basically had to derive its meaning from things that were alive in the contemporary world. Fortunately or unfortunately, there were plenty of those around. And there were politics, both the politics of the so-called democratic countries like the United States and Britain, and also the politics of the third world dictators and the fundamentalisms of the world. All of this made for a world in which Orwell's themes were alive and well.
And then the dead hand of all that bureaucracy and euphemism and BS, whatever you want to call it, turned up way outside of government, too, in insurance companies and in advertising. I'm just wondering, for yourself, imagining Orwell walking among us today, where would he be looking for Big Brother, Big Brotherism, and where would he be finding it?
Well, I think he'd be looking all over the place and finding it all over the place. I think he certainly would find the language of advertising big brotherish, big brotherly, perhaps I should say. I think he would find it also in the propaganda of any number of countries, including the United States. I think he would find, for example, the whole idea that everything about the market world, everything is good. or that the United States is always on the side of democracy, understood in a kind of ordinary language sense, I think he would find those were things that he would like to, those were language usages that he would like to puncture.
What about mass culture? What about television? What about a TV reality show called Big Brother?
Oh, God, what Orwell would make of reality TV.
He'd go
now,
back.
Chris, this is, you know, I'm being unfairly treated here. I don't, that is a question that would take some pondering. I think he would just be enormously disgusted by it. And I think he would begin by pointing out the obvious things, that reality TV is quite far from reality. And it is a kind of peculiar kind of sort of social Darwinian theater that's basically its function is to amuse people, not really to imitate life.
I wonder, among our listeners, I mean, we all had to read 1984, not that we shouldn't have had to read it, and probably Animal Farm in high school and college. Have we read it since then? I mean, were we too young when we first encountered it? There's a freshness in Orwell that's kind of shocking when you go back, I mean, to the famous essays like The Politics of the English Language, or in some of the almost as famous essays about Kipling and Darwin and about shooting an elephant. To give the man credit, I mean, quite apart from the problems of our time, there's a clarity, there's a chilling just kind of freshness about that language, Tom, that's just amazing.
He was the greatest essayist of the 20th century in English, certainly, and probably in any language, and also, I think, the greatest aphorist. If you look around and see what is quoted from 20th century writers, I think if you were to do a fairly serious survey of that, you'd discover that Orwell is way more quoted than anybody else.
That's exactly what he said about Kipling, and he said it in sort of disparaging Kipling. He wasn't a great writer, but he did contribute great phrases like East is East and West is West.
He travels fastest who travels alone.
Yeah.
Things like that.
But when you think of the great Orwellisms, which ones are you thinking of?
Well, for example, let's see, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others, for example, is a good one. I think it probably got at the essence of the bureaucratization of Soviet communism as well as any single sentence possibly could. Goodness, let's see, when you want them, they don't come so readily to mind.
I have a cheat sheet, how's this? For just plain brilliant language, he says, and thinking, every war, when it comes, or before it comes, is represented not as a war, but as an act of self-defense against a homicidal maniac.
Oh, I like that. I think it's very good.
How about this? If you want, this is too tough, but it's brilliant. If you want a vision of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
Forever, yes.
877-673-6767 is our George Orwell open source phone with Tom Gleason. 877-673-6767. We're talking about the maybe eternal relevance of a writer who died, when, 1950, with Abbott Gleason of Brown University. Would he find anything redeeming in this world today, do you think, Tom Gleason? And who would he like in the politics of 2005?
You know, I don't know. Half the politicians who know his name would claim him. And in fact, claiming Orwell has been a kind of a cottage industry for a long time. But he was so much his own man that it's awfully hard to see him signing up under any of the currently available rubrics. I think Christopher Hitchens, who's written a very interesting and very lively book on Orwell, identifies with Orwell, and he would like to see himself as a kind of Orwell figure today. But I'm not sure. I think I really couldn't think of anybody that Orwell would actually would hang out a shingle with.
Hitchens is funny because he gets you into the question of the war in Iraq, which Hitchens has supported, and the American role in the world, which Orwell really never saw, and never kind of treated exactly, but that's another dimension. Who do you think of as the great co-opters or suck-ups, shall we say, to Orwell? Who has tried most assiduously to identify with that spirit?
Well, since there is no real left in the English-speaking world anymore, I think we have to say that it was the first generation of the neoconservatives, people like Irving Kristol and especially Norman Podhoretz. Podhoretz wrote a famous article called If Orwell Were Alive Today, claiming him for the neocons. And I think there's some justification for that, but not too much. And I think if Orwell were confronted with the economic policies of the current administration, tax credits for the rich, trickle-down economics, that kind of thing, it would be very, very clear that in most basic respects, Orwell is still a man of the left, even if the left doesn't really exist anymore.
How did Podhoretz pull it off? I mean, what's the evidence that Orwell...
Well, I'm not sure he pulled it off, but basically what he said was Orwell was a left-wing intellectual who was moving right, and the further right he moved, the greater his work and the more effective it was. So that's one thing.
Well, he repented of communism and the Spanish Civil War in Homage to Catalonia, but where else?
Well, I think the whole of his writing during World War II and into Animal Farm and 1984 is really all about anti-communism and what Orwell called anti-totalitarianism. I think the greatest satire, the most lively and brilliant satire on communism ever was Animal Farm.
Yes.
I think that writing was really, and in fact, Orwell himself said every scrap of serious work that I've done since 1940 was against totalitarianism. So I'm sure that Podhoretz would cite that.
Well, he might, I suppose. But then what? 877-673-6767 is the open source phone. We're talking about the immortal George Orwell and what he would see and say and hear in our culture today with Abbot Tom Gleason from Brown University. We'll be back.
Hi, this is Brendan on the Blogger-in-Chief. We are looking for Creative Commons licensed instrumental music. You can submit yours at radioopensource.org, where you can also right now find an interview with the composer for the motion picture Tarnation. We have been using his music during the show. As you all know, every show has a life on the blog before we put it on the radio. Follow those lives at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI.
I was at a small dinner party, and one of my friends made a kind of offhand joke about how 1984 should be shelved in the nonfiction section. And everybody laughed, and then about 5 seconds later, I just said, wait, you know, we could actually do that. We posted a PDF that you could print out and cut up into bookmarks. They say that this book has been relocated by the Ministry of Reshelving, dedicated to the proper classification of fiction and nonfiction texts. Some bookstore employees looked the other way and didn't say anything. We had one manager from Portland, Maine, email me yesterday. He says, I'm the manager and will be able to make sure they remain between Joseph Wilson's The Politics of Truth and the Terrorist Recognition Handbook for as long as the store is in business.
That was Jane McGonigal of the Ministry of Reshelving Project. In less than 2 weeks, the project has reshelved copies of 1984 in Canada, the United Kingdom, the Philippines, and half the states in our union. You can find links to the project at radioopensource.org. Jeffrey Nunberg joins us by phone from California. He's a linguist at Stanford University and the author of Going Nuclear. Jeffrey Nunberg, walk George Orwell around the American political vocabulary in 2005.
Well, you know, I think Orwell would see a lot of things to comment on. The names of bills like healthy forests and clear skies.
The Clear Skies Initiative.
The Clear Skies Initiative. He'd certainly see it in the operation that the Department of Homeland Security announced that was called Liberty Shield, which authorized the detention of asylum speakers, seekers for indefinite lengths of time. You know, and other people might see it. The people on the right who claim Orwell would see it in hear an Orwellian note in phrases like reproductive health services for abortion clinics or diversity training or things like that. And what's very interesting, is, as Professor Gleason was saying, is that each side has found it very convenient to claim Orwell when it wants to decry the jargon and euphemisms of the other side. Of course, when our side does it, it's not Orwellian, it's just effective branding.
It's Orwell-esque.
Right.
What about the Coalition of the Willing? What about the Axis of Evil?
Well, Coalition of the Willing is certainly one that Orwell would have had a good time with, and perhaps with Axis of Evil, which has that that same resonance. But, you know, I think the other point about this is that the readiness with which people invoke that, if you look at on the web and in the press, Orwellian has become the single most common adjective derived from the name of a writer. It's more common even than Machiavellian, which had a 500-year head start.
And if you press people on it, nobody knows what the hell it means.
Well, it's what they say. It's the language
of
the other
side. Orwellian is what I say.
it's what the other side says. What we do, as I say, is effective branding.
Or it's the other side is brainwashing you. Tom Gleason, are there phrases here you want to add? I mean, No Child Left Behind, does that meet the Orwellian standard?
Well, unless the funding increases, it certainly does.
No billionaire left behind. But here's the trick I'd like to ask you both about. Orwell was a man for straight speech, plain language, solid Anglo-Saxon short words like hack, and yet we now have an industry in our politics, you know, Ronald Reagan may have perfected it, of hiring geniuses to write these phrases and to deliver them in a homey way that sounds so plain folks. I mean, this is Orwell cubed in a way.
Well, I think the generation of political language and advertising is really even worse now than it was in Orwell's time. And in fact, I think when you hear the advertising of the 1940s and early 1950s, it seems really childish by comparison. So I think Orwell would feel that things have gone quite far in the wrong direction since his death.
What would you say, Jeffrey Nunberg, about, Newspeak 2.0 or Plainspeak 2.0, this kind of manufactured straight talk?
Yeah, I think in a funny way, when people talk about Orwellian language, they have in mind more these mouth-filling euphemisms that in some sense wear their euphemicity on their sleeve, where the language you really have to look out for, and I think Orwell was very much aware of this, is this plain talk. It's words like values or regime or life, the way life is used nowadays. These aren't the sorts of words that people are apt to call Orwellian. In fact, they're words that people very often use without reflecting on them. But those are the words with which most of the political mischief is worked nowadays. And certainly the best or most skillful users of political language, and this includes Reagan, it includes Clinton, it includes George W. Bush, who's a very skillful user of language, whatever the book on him is.
His writers certainly are.
Are people who manage to use the language in what sounds like a clear, plain-spoken way without pretension or seeming just to communicate in a direct way. And that's, in fact, the most dangerous form of political communication, not the overblown euphemisms and Latinisms that Orwell spent a lot of time on and that people tend to associate with him.
I completely agree. I think, in fact, Orwell has had a powerful impact on bad language, because essentially everyone now tries to imitate Orwell and to appear to be speaking in the kind of language that Orwell recommended. And I think that's exactly correct. That is when dissimulation is the deepest and clearest threat.
Yeah, I think there's a passage in Lear where Cornwall says, "These kinds of knaves I know, which in this plainness harbor more craft and more corrupter ends than 20 silly ducking observants that stretch their duties nicely." And I think it's an old point, but it's still a true one, that the when you hear somebody talking plain and making a point of talking plain, that you really want to put your hand on your wallet.
It's great to have that quotation at your disposal, Professor. I will try to study that one myself and have it available when I need it.
It's filed under Shakespeare.
Right.
877-673-6767 is the open source phone. We're talking about George Orwell. Would that he were among us. Richard is on the line from South Natick, Massachusetts.
Yes.
Welcome, Richard.
Nice to have you back on the air.
And you too.
I wanted to tell you that in one of the post-war essays that he wrote, George Orwell said, "If you want to promote international ill will, run international sports." And I think that's been carried out to an unfortunate extent in many ways in the international scene between one country and another, owing unfortunately to the national pride and national beatiness, in fact, about competition.
Richard, that's a terrifically interesting point. There's an hour's conversation right there about George Orwell watching the Olympics, the politicized, violent Cold War, you know.
That's right.
Remember that Afghanistan runner? All the commentary on that. He didn't approve much of sports.
Well, I think he approved of sport as sport, but what he didn't approve of was sport as a manipulated form of diplomacy.
He said sport is war minus the shooting.
Yes. Sport is national prestige.
It has nothing to do with fair play. It is bound up with hatred, jealousy, boastfulness, disregard of all rules, and sadistic pleasure in witnessing violence. In other words, as I say, war minus the shooting.
Well, that's a wonderful quotation you just produced.
It's a wonderful call. Richard, thank you.
Right, thank you.
877-673-6767. Jackie is calling from Melrose, Massachusetts.
Hi, great to talk to you again, Christopher.
Thank you, Jackie.
I think that Karl Rove would be the man who could write a book like that today. He's writing all the fine lines, bringing peace to Iraq, and not only that, but bringing peace to the whole Middle East through war, and even talking about bringing them freedom. They've never had our freedoms. Well, of course, they love to have freedom like ours, freedom from the United States occupying them. And then this constant mantra that I'm sure Karl Rove was behind that. He's right next to the president, I think still probably, telling him, always say, since 9/11, and he did it again today. It was yesterday or today, big speech out west. He again talked about, since 9/11, we have to do this and that. Since 9/11, it's just like a little song that he sings all the time.
Jackie, I'm glad you mentioned it. There's another whole hour in Orwell After 9/11, Tom Gleason, but would you just give us the highlights?
The highlights of
the relevance or the eye and ear of George Orwell on this world after 9/11, including the war on terror, but also the war on Iraq.
Well, I think for starters, Orwell would not recognize the idea that everything changed after 9/11. 9/11 was an awful event, and it was certainly an awful event, especially for Americans who never had anything happen on their soil like that. But I think Orwell would be deeply skeptical of the idea that everything changed after 9/11. Hypocrisy is still hypocrisy. Essentially, bad language is still bad language. Imprecision is imprecision. The powerful manipulate the powerless. The world, in fact, I think he would say quickly, goes on in a rather similar way to the way it had in the past. So he would simply reject the idea that 9/11 changed everything.
877-673-6767 is our phone. Jim is calling from Groton, New Hampshire.
Speaking. Jim Sutton, how are you?
Excellent, Jim.
Good. In essence, I just wanted to say that George Orwell could not possibly have understood the current world that we live in, and the fact that we've got computers and cell phones that are liberating people, such as the Chinese, at least one hopes that they're being liberated by such methods of communication, as well as the rest of the world. I mean, the man was wonderful. We all read his books. I love him to this day. You know, just everything he said was brilliant. But the fact is, what we live in today is a different world. And
but this joins the question about Orwell and technology.
I beg your pardon?
Technology was bad news, and he didn't see the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm.
What would he say about the Internet that we love? He would not have liked it.
Oh, I'm not sure that he wouldn't have liked it. He certainly liked the radio and didn't have was very nervous about the ways to which mass technologies and mass communication could be deployed. But I don't know that he would have disliked the Internet, or that he wouldn't have wound up as a blogger if he were.
But now there's a difference. But this is important, Jeffrey. He was wary about broadcasting. He was wary even of cinema. Because
don't you think
of the
that he
control
would been...
that was required, the capital and the giantism implied. I think he was wary of broadcasting. I think he would have loved podcasting, the individual voice. But the big voice, I think even on the Internet, he would have been worried about who's going to control it down the road.
And don't
think
you think
right.
that identity theft would have been an issue for him were he in a position to understand it? And the loss of privacy that goes with
yeah, amen. Here's
but Internet. I think there are some things that Orwell, in retrospect, turned out not to get quite right. One of them is that Orwell's assumption was always that the enemy of plain speaking and so on was public indifference. He wrote at one point that a reduced state of consciousness is favorable to political conformity.
Yes.
And one of the interesting lessons about Orwell's very popularity, I mean, this is a man who is, as you say, taught in the schools. If you look at the Amazon.com's list of perennial bestsellers, the two works of fiction that are perennially in the top 100 are 1984 and Catcher in the Rye.
Hmm.
And politics in the English language is taught in virtually every school. Everybody's aware of Orwell. Everybody uses the word Orwellian. Everybody thinks him or herself hip to the mischief that political language can work. And yet, it works anyway. And I think one of the things that Orwell would have been surprised at would be to go into the communications department of a modern corporation, which is as close as we get, I suppose, to the Ministry of Truth in 1984, and find that all these people, even as they were producing this language, were making fun of it and posting Dilbert scripts on the walls of their cubicles. And what we've learned is that the manipulative use of language can coexist with a high level of public suspicion and wariness about language.
Interesting.
And with a great deal of sophistication about how language works.
That's a very good point.
Very well phrased. Would George Orwell be able to laugh about it? I mean, the incredible irony that you can, for all the warnings, you know, we still fall for it, and we still do it.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd be interested to know what Professor Gleason thinks, whether he would have laughed, whether he was
not a big laugher.
Kind of laughter.
Was he, Tom?
Well, he an ironical smile was more his style. I think he was fundamentally a gloomy and lonely and a person who bordered on bitter. So I think that I don't think he would laugh about it. I think he would say, well, the good thing about the world that they inhabit now is that the bomb has not been used since the end of World War II. The bad thing is that in almost every other way it's gotten worse.
Interesting. 877-673-6767 is our phone. Jim in New Hampshire, thank you. Lane is on the line from Brooklyn, New York.
Hi, I just wanted to say, I like all your guests and most of your callers, I am influenced by Orwell and think that his writing, especially politics in the English language, was a huge influence on me. I can actually find a point in my master's thesis where I read it and my writing completely changed. I was embarrassed about everything I'd done up to that point. But
me too.
Professor Nunberg made the point that it's quite possible and quite common, actually, to lie using plain language. And Orwell made the point in that essay that if you spoke plainly, if you used vivid, fresh language, that it would basically expose any falsehood. But I think the point has been drawn out by the caller calling about Karl Rove, that it's quite possible to be just as deceitful using plain language as it is using fancy language and euphemism. And I think that's something that Orwell was pretty explicitly wrong on, but I'd like to get to the professor and the other professor's thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's right. He had an idea that if you just looked at the world, and this was something you find in Auden and other writers of that period, if you just looked at the world, you could try to think wordlessly, as he put it, and somehow thoughts that grew right out of the nature of the world itself, that just directly observed, would be the ones that you would express in the plainest language, and it would be the truest to the world. What we've learned is that plain language is in a way more deceptive than the sorts of euphemisms that we describe Orwellian, precisely because it's opaque when you hold it up to the light. You can't see through the words that people use. These words just seem so ordinary and so much a part of everyday life that we don't hold them up and question them.
But he was also talking about a very dynamic relationship between language and politics, backward and forward. Both can corrupt each other, but he would also say that they could both clarify and, I don't want to say redeem, but kind of make sense of the other. I mean, take a phrase, is this a foolproof phrase or not? War against a foreign country only happens when the moneyed classes think they're going to profit from it. Now, I pose that as a sort of test. Can you take that language and say, and then apply it to reality and come out with a beneficial result in a foolproof way?
That comes really from Orwell's Marxist period, and I think probably at the end of his life he would have come to believe that as an overstatement. But I think, you know, basically Orwell would not have been surprised that lying is done differently now and that there are new styles of lying have arisen, even as older styles of lying were becoming less effective. So the impulse to lie, deceive, and prevaricate, I think Orwell would have understood as a very, very deep-seated human tendency.
Well, but would he have said that as thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought? Would he also say that language can purify or cleanse politics as politics can cleanse language?
I think he believed that if you spoke simply and if you allowed as the world to determine your thoughts, if you spoke in words that were connected imminently to the world, that you would think more clearly. And there's surely a deep truth in that, but there's also a truth in the notion that those plain words that come most readily to mind and so on can be, in a way, the most deceptive of all. Mm-hmm. Because they're words that we have no protection against those words. We're not immune to those words. We can't be inured to their effect on us.
Jeffrey Nunberg, stand by, and Tom Gleason at Brown University, stand by. We're talking about George Orwell of Animal Farm and 1984 and those great essays like Shooting an Elephant and Dickens and Kipling that we've barely touched. 877-673-6767 is our phone. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about George Orwell, 55 years after his death, and he lives on more vividly than we can imagine. 877-673-6767. Cal is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hello, Cal.
Well, I want to first thank you so much for raising the whole point of George Orwell and its relevance to today, and your two wonderfully lucid guests.
Thank you, Cal.
They really are saying all the things that interpret Orwell correctly for us. But the problem that strikes me is that in a way, we are all complicit in rejecting Orwell, in that people say that they revere him, but at the same time, they're practicing a kind of language distortion themselves.
What are the worst examples, Cal?
Well, on the web and in the press, those topical branding jargon that earlier was spoken of is obviously accepted or acknowledged because everybody uses it. I think the most egregious example, and probably not one of the most used ones, is Operation Iraqi Freedom. But too often, we see in the newspapers and online those kinds of stupid, empty tags for people to hang on.
You know, they were going to call it Operation Iraqi Liberation, but then it turned out the acronym was OIL, so they dropped it.
No doubt. But anyway, you're just wonderful, and the callers have had wonderful answers, and at least there are some of us who still understand Orwell's words.
Thank you, Cal. 877-673-6767 joins the Orwell conversation. Andy is calling from Marlboro, Massachusetts.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, Andy.
You know, one person that I think does a real good job of being our modern-day Orwell would be Jon Stewart from The Daily Show.
Amen. Good point.
You know,
very good
point. I
mean,
all he does is run clips of what W just said today with a smirk on his face and kind of looking around into the crowd to see if anybody actually believed what he just said had anything to do with reality. You know, I mean, he just points out that so many of the people in our world today really kind of are Orwellian characters.
That's a brilliant point, Andy, and I was trying to think and didn't get there. I was thinking of Norman Mailer, especially a few years ago, had a kind of Orwell's role. And again, a literary man, you know, in the ring, at the center of the ring in politics. Jimmy Breslin, maybe? But are there other sort of contemporary Orwells that we can think of? I think Jon Stewart clears the decks. I mean, I think that's brilliant.
But I think one characteristic of Orwell, that's what led Lionel Trilling to describe Orwell as a literary figure, his role as a figure, was that he also was involved, as you point out. He went to Barcelona and took part in the Spanish Civil War. He worked. I mean, he allowed himself to experience the life of the working class in a way that, for all I enjoy them, people like Jon Stewart and Norman Mailer haven't, or they played at it. And
Jon Stewart has not been to the coal fields, as far as we know.
Yeah, right. Maybe Barbara Ehrenreich.
Good point.
She went there. She did it. She paid her dues.
877-673-6767 joins the conversation on George Orwell. Julia is calling from Tippsford, Vermont. Hello, Julia.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
It's a pleasure.
I'm at a payphone. We might get drowned out periodically. But I'm a retired English teacher, and I've taught shooting an elephant. And I guess I would describe Orwell not. I don't think he was a dissembler the way you just described Bush, who definitely is a dissembler. I think Orwell. I think the more useful term would be he had a very heightened sense of the ironic, and then he married that with a sense of outrage. And if you really look at if you read shooting an elephant, students may dismiss it as being sort of old and, you know, that was then, this is now. But if you do a close reading of that essay, he's really depicting the white man's burden. And the character is caught, he is caught as the narrator, in a highly ironic situation where his position is to preserve the peace and enforce the law. And he has to commit this outrageous act, and everyone knows it's outrageous, but because he's there in that position, he has to carry it out, and he doesn't want to carry it out. And everybody's watching him with this sort of mixture of hatred and disgust and fear of the colonized people. And I just think that in his scene of the actual death of the elephant, he casts away. He's built the ironic situation to that point, and then he just casts it away and describes it in very direct terms. And it's a real knockout if you just sit and ponder it.
Julia, I have it in hand. I've been reading it the last few days. It's such a brilliant piece, and you cannot read it and not think of American troops in Iraq. I mean, he's shooting the elephant because he thinks it's expected of him as the kind of representative of the British Empire to do rather an outrageous act. And he says, as I stood there with the rifle in my hand, it was at this moment that I first grasped the hollowness, the futility of the white man's dominion in the East. And it's the beginning of, as you say, of a much bigger and ironic reflection on empire. But I just wonder, Tom Gleason, what we make of that piece, the political piece, the anti-imperial piece of George Orwell in the world today.
Well, I think it really shows the degree to which we are all the prisoner of systems, and the systems, whether they're communist systems or other ones, essentially, even the dictators, even the people who run the system, are prisoners of it and are part of it and are not even themselves free.
Yeah, amen. Jeffrey Nunberg, do you want to add on that?
No, I think Professor Gleason's put the point very well. I think one point to bear in mind, and this again Professor Gleason was saying, is that Orwell's very popularity tends to obscure the complexity and depth of the man. When you drive around out here, at least in the Bay Area last year around this time during the election, you'd see these bumper stickers that said Bush and Orwell in 2004. Right? And I understand what they're getting at,
it's
but it
so
also seems a little unfair to Orwell. It is as if Orwell has become this figure who's really associated only with these two novels, 1984 and Animal Farm, and maybe that one essay. And people, and particularly Americans, I think, don't appreciate him in the complexity of his political thought, of his development. They don't read works like Homage to Catalonia or Down and Out in Paris and London or...
How about The Road to Wigan Pier?
The Road to Wigan Pier. These are wonderful works, and to my mind, much better and more interesting works than 1984 or Animal Farm. I understand why those works continue to be read, but as literary works, I think the earlier works in a certain sense are stronger, and they're not read, and Americans just don't really know anything about those works or about Orwell the man.
Well, we should. 877-673-6767 is the open source phone. Talking about George Orwell, Dennis is calling from Manchester, New Hampshire.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Dennis.
Thank you. I read The Road to Wigan Pier about 20 years ago, and I worked with a fellow from Britain who told me that there is no pier in Wigan. It's a coal mining town. But I read the book, and one thing that, if I remember correctly, that really hit me was these are very, very poor mining families, coal miners who from Wigan. But they always, they scrape, they would never... all their little resources they had, but they never gave up their tea and sugar in the afternoons. And it reminds me a lot, and that was how they participated in the society. They always had enough money for tea and sugar. That's like in Brazil where you look at the lower classes and how were they managed. They were managed because the government gave them soccer and carnival. And even in America, you look at, I've been in supermarkets and I've seen people with food stamps and they'll buy Twinkies and Coke. And that's how they participate in the American society. That's how the only level they can buy in. And I that's what struck me with George Orwell. And I'm just curious what your
I'm glad you mentioned it. I remember The Road to Wigan Pier as his effort to break out of a kind of London literary politics and to rediscover how hard, incredibly hard, people actually worked in England. And he went in those in, those endless tunnels, climbing on his belly, I believe for miles, with these workers whose whole bodies had been deformed by doing this all day, every day, for years after year after year. To me, just the reporting energy, as well as the kind of self-humbling of discovering how tough life was in England in the 30s, is kind of heartrending, but hugely impressive. What do you make of it, Tom Gleason? I should be asking you.
Well, I think for me the most heartrending aspect of the Road to Wigan Pier, and especially the Road to Wigan Pier, is that I think it displays a very, very deep paradox about Orwell himself, which is that he stood for, as no one in the 20th century seemed to symbolically, a kind of Protestant individualism and a kind of individual integrity. At the same time, there was a side of Orwell that longed to do the very thing that he scorned to do, and that is to join into collectivities. Hmm. So he was hostile to the collectivity of the Catholic Church, but he wanted to become part of some collectivity of workers, and yet he was really unable to abandon the sort of individualism that he stood for. So he was caught. There's a kind of romantic underside of Orwell, as well as the sort of Protestant individualist upper side.
That's interesting. Jeffrey Nunberg, anything to add?
No, I think Tom Gleason puts that very well. And I think when you read Homage to Catalonia, I actually was just in Barcelona a couple of months ago and reread that book, and it's an extraordinary book. What a wonderful book. One of the best pieces of war writing, war journalism, whatever you want to call it, that's ever been done, I think. And that sense that he has with relation to the troops of, on the one hand, being this alien figure who's standing on the side and observing, and at the same time, as Tom's saying, the longing to participate, to be one of the troops, is just very poignant and trenchant in that novel, in that book.
There are a couple of other things there we don't have time to cover fully, but first of all, somebody mentioned the things he didn't like, including the Catholic Church. Short list, Tom Gleason, of maybe some of the politically incorrect things that he was attached to or repelled by.
Well, I think one of the things that would strike us now about Orwell, were he to come back and sort of indicate his prejudices, is his dislike of homosexuality. I think this was a very powerful feeling in his life, and I think now a days it would be much more jarring to many people who admire Orwell than it was then. His ambivalent attitude toward the left, of course, is this thing that conservatives like about him. But I think this sort of use of symbols like sandals, and the anti-gay rhetoric, I think those things would strike us as unpalatable. I think probably his attitude toward women and his belief in what the function of women was, as seen by the Julia relationship, Julia and Winston in 1984. I think that people would be hard on that.
What would he make of blogging, which is in itself a kind of very individual search for new communities and affinities out there? Would he be blogging today?
I think he might very well be. I mean, it's of course silly to ask whether Orwell would have been blogging, but I think he might very well have been a blogger. It would have given him the opportunity to write short essays in complete freedom from any kind of editorial control, and to write prolifically, which was something he was very good at.
I wish you would both touch a little bit on some of those early essays, and then maybe the literary essays that you think we ought to know about. And George Orwell, the reader, starting with the Kipling or Dickens. Jeffrey Nunberg?
Yeah, I think I haven't read those essays in so long now, but I remember thinking that Orwell got Dickens wrong, and I'd be interested to hear what Tom Gleason has to say about that.
Well, one of the interesting things is that the best essays, it seems to me, that he did and I would put the Dickens essay and the Kipling essay up there. He was best when he could see and discern things in writers like Dickens that were really aspects of his own self-portrait, particularly an idealized self-portrait. So a lot of the wonderful ending to the Dickens essay about the smelly little orthodoxies, the phrase about Dickens as a writer who is well worth stealing, the idea of the man who is angry but generously angry, it seems to me these are all Orwell talking about things that he aspired to himself.
Interesting. Now, he was much tougher on Kipling, but in a totally different way, and yet there was something of himself there too.
Yes, I think so. Kipling, he was tougher on Kipling because, of course, Kipling was an imperialist. And one of the things that Christopher Hitchens says in his very entertaining commentary on Orwell is that Orwell got all the most important things about the first half of the 20th century right, whatever he got wrong, and that is he was anti-communist, he was anti-fascist, and he was anti-imperialist.
Which leaves out, as has been noted by lots of others, the question of America. Do you want to tackle that?
Yes. Well, actually, Hitchens makes a good deal of that in his book, and others as well, that he never really dealt with the question of America and of the American sphere. I think because he was so obsessed with the Sovietization of Eastern Europe and with communism as a phenomenon that he really didn't want to come to grips or didn't feel able to come to grips or somehow neglected to come to grips with the idea, which was common on the French left and other places that he was hostile to, that the United States itself.
Did he ever come to this country?
A danger. I don't believe so, no.
I don't think he did.
And there was also this obsession, I don't think it's unfair to call it that, with Englishness that ran through his work. And in some ways a very old-fashioned 18th century sense of Englishness. It's there in the Dickens essay. It's there in The Lion and the Unicorn. It's there in 1984 in a curious way, that this search for the English character.
Jeffrey Nunberg, thank you. We've got a lot of reading to do, starting tonight in our collected Orwell. Thank you, Tom Gleason. This has been fun. Thank you to the callers. Visit our blog at Radio Open Source, where you can talk about tonight's program and help us work on the next one. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, training practitioners and students for leadership in human rights. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, Robin Amer, and Vanessa Bertozzi. Mike Wilkins was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source. PRI, Public Radio International.